When I was a boy, I nearly drowned. I grew up in a fishing village where everything is about the water and the wind and the catch. I was 9, maybe 10 years old. It was my first time out on the water with the men, my father, my uncle, my older brothers. And all I wanted to do was be like them, to impress them, show them I was ready to take my part. It was early in the morning, just before dawn. There was a stiff breeze coming in off the lake, and I was cold, but I did my best not to show it. I was just a kid, so they didn't give me any real tasks. There's only one thing I needed to do: stay clear of the nets. You know, it's funny in life. Often, the one thing you know not to do, it's the one thing you end up doing. The men tossed out the net, this huge, heavy, thick thing, and I was standing too close. My ankle got caught, and I was flung overboard into the water, tangled up. I knew how to swim, but I panicked, thrashing and kicking, making the whole thing worse. I opened my mouth and swallowed great gulps of water, and I remember knowing it. I was going to drown. And then my father was in the water, slicing at the net, dragging me to the surface. He lifted me back into the boat, where I coughed and coughed and wiped away the water, hoping it looked like seawater and not like I was crying. He bent down close to look in my face, see if I was okay. And when he saw that I was, the concern vanished. "Some fisherman you'll be," he said. And years later, another man told me the same thing, but he meant something entirely different. Well, I grew up and became a fisherman, got married, started a family. And every night when they went to bed, I went back out to the lake. My brother Andrew and I, we spent the darkness chasing fish, casting out the nets till our arms gave way, grateful for whatever we could pull in to sell and feed our family. Now, fishermen have their superstitions. You can get stuck in a spell where the fish want nothing to do with you. You're just doing time on the water, waiting for your luck to turn. And after our father passed, we were stuck in a spell like that. Night after fruitless night. It was hopeless. I began to worry that it would always be this way, that my life would always be this way, throwing out nets and bringing them back empty. Well, one morning we were sitting by the shore, scrubbing down the boat, mending our nets. I was getting pretty tired of the routine. And down the way, a crowd was gathering around a local rabbi, Jesus from Nazareth. I'd heard him speak a couple of times. I'd even spoken with him. I respected him, the way any Jewish man respects a rabbi. But honestly, my relationship with God at that point was a little like my relationship with fish. We weren't really connecting. But this Jesus was drawing a crowd, and they kept pressing him. And he moved farther and farther down the shore until he backed right into our boat. And when his feet hit it, he looked down and saw me as if he was relieved. "Ah, Simon," he said. And he got into the boat and sat down. "Take me out a ways," he said. Now, that was the last thing in the world I wanted to do. But now all these people were watching me, so So I got in the boat with Jesus. For the first of many, many times. And I rowed out a ways, and he began to teach. He spoke to the people from the boat. I only half listened. I was tired. And when he was done, I picked up the oars to row back in, but he stopped me. "Let's go farther out," he said, "and throw out the nets." "Really, Jesus?" I was a sorry fisherman indeed if some rabbi was going to tell me how to do my job. "Teacher," I tried to explain, "we were out all night. We caught nothing." But he was already pointing to a spot out on the lake. "Right there," he said. Now, Jesus, he wasn't arrogant, but he had authority. When he asked you to do something, you got the feeling you probably should. So I rowed out a ways and threw out the net. I wasn't expecting anything until the moment I let it go. The moment that net left my hand, I got this sense, this shiver, like the drought in my life was about to end. And sure enough, soon as that net hit the water, there was a tug, a huge tug, as if every fish in the lake had charged my net. "Andrew, Andrew," I shouted. He jumped in the boat with a few guys, their eyes wide as the morning sun. And soon we were hauling in fish, more fish than I have ever seen in one catch. I had been curious, I'd been amazed, but now suddenly I was afraid. I mean, who was this? I looked at this teacher, Jesus, and I fell down at his feet in the watery bottom of the boat. "Please, Lord, just leave. Just go away." Now, I know what you're thinking. Why would I send him away? The guy clearly knew how to fish. All I can say is you can hope for a miracle. You can go to a temple and pray to the divine. But when you actually encounter it, when suddenly God is sitting in your boat, it's scary. "Just go away, Lord. I'm a sinful man." I didn't want to meet his eye. But when I looked up at him, he was studying me, looking at me as if to understand who I was. And if he could do that, he was way ahead of me. "Simon," he said, "don't be afraid. From now on, you will fish for people." And that day, I became his disciple. Not because I felt obligated, or because I hated fishing or my life as it was, and I wasn't especially religious or good. I became his disciple because I wanted to be around Jesus. And he invited us, me and Andrew, and a couple of other brothers, James and John. And soon there were more, and then 12 of us. "Follow me," he said, "and I will make you fishers of men." I didn't understand it all, not then, not now. But I went, we all did. And day by day, lesson by lesson, we shadowed Jesus, as he taught us, showed us the kingdom of God, where the weak could be champions, where things that were broken could be made whole again, where a regular fisherman could change the world. And we traveled all kinds of places with him, cities and villages, mountains, farms. But for me, it's funny how God works. For me, my biggest moments have always happened by the water. And one time, on it. We had just heard that John the Baptizer was dead, murdered by Herod. When Jesus heard, he was upset, unsettled. We could tell he needed some time to be alone, to think. But the crowds were relentless. When we finally were able to get free of them, he sent us on ahead in the boat, and he went up into the hills by himself. Now, you have to understand, you can respect the sea, you can work with the sea, but make no mistake, the sea is not your friend. The sea owes you nothing. No matter how many times you've crossed the Sea of Galilee, you hold your breath every time, because the sea can change in an instant, without warning. Even a seasoned sailor can misjudge the signs, or just be too tired to notice. I was actually sleeping in the boat that night when those cold, wet drops splashed into my face. I woke in an instant and immediately roused the other guys. The wind had picked up from out of nowhere and was blowing now full tilt, waves coming over the side of the boat. We were in trouble, and we knew it. Some of the men began to pray. James grabbed a bucket and began to bail. And frankly, I think he had the right idea. You never want to let a storm creep up on you while you're asleep. And the only thing you want to see less than a storm is a ghost. It was about the fourth watch of the night. We were frantically rowing and bailing and praying, and suddenly we saw something coming towards us on the water. It looked like a man walking on the white caps. Somebody swore. Fishermen have a way with words. The rest of us just stared, silent in terror. Andrew looked like he was going to jump overboard and swim for it. But as the figure came closer, we realized it was Jesus. "It's me," he shouted, like we had just bumped into him in town. "Don't be afraid." "Yeah, right." But you know, with the wind blowing in my face that night, out there in the dark, I got this feeling. Like I'd been afraid all my life of the waves of the storm, and I didn't want to be anymore. And if Jesus said, "Don't be afraid," then maybe I didn't have to be. So I shouted into the wind, "Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water." And immediately, the answer came back, "Come." The boat rocked beneath my feet as I stood up unsteadily. I awkwardly lifted one foot over the side of the boat, took a deep breath as if I was going to dive in, and then I just forced myself out of that boat. And I almost laughed out loud. I was standing more firmly on the water than I had been in that floating piece of wood that was supposed to keep us safe. And out there, looking at Jesus, it was like every ounce of my being was alive, like I was invincible. I can't explain it, but I'm telling you, for a few minutes, I was doing it. I was walking on water toward Jesus, and it was glorious. But then the thunder cracked overhead, and a gust of wind hit me. And I turned away and looked back to see how far I was from the boat, and immediately I began to sink. The water came to my ankles, to my knees. "Lord, help me," I cried, and he did. He reached out and grabbed me, lifted me up, and together we stepped back into the boat, huffing and puffing, dripping wet. "You of little faith," he said. And then he smiled. "Why did you doubt?" Why did I doubt? But you know, I had a question for him. Why did he let me do it? I mean, why did he call me out there on the water? It was a crazy idea. And it wasn't like it was something spiritual, not like preaching a sermon or healing someone of blindness. But maybe it was. Because out there on the water, my eyes were opened in a whole new way. Now, I still had a lot to learn and plenty more mistakes to make. But some months later, when he asked that most important question, "Who do you say that I am?" the answer came out of my mouth as strong as the storm that had taught me the truth. "You are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God." That day, he called me Peter, Petros. My whole life had been about water. Could I ever be a rock? I didn't know, but I believed in him, that he was the Messiah. I didn't know what it all meant, and I certainly didn't know where it would all lead. It all came to a head some months later at the Passover. We all went up together to Jerusalem for the Holy Day, along with Jesus, the 12 of us. They welcomed him like a hero that day, like a king coming to his city. And it should have felt good. But behind the scenes, things were beginning to fray. We were bickering more than usual. Not Jesus, but the rest of us. Pestering him with questions like, which one was the greatest, and other kinds of nonsense. Truth is, we'd been traveling together too long at that point. We knew how to press each other's buttons, even those of us who weren't brothers to begin with. And Jesus, well, he was in a mood too. One moment he'd be all warm and friendly, telling us how wonderful it was to be celebrating the Passover with us. And then all of a sudden he would get dark and talk about suffering and pain and his own death. Finally, I put my foot down. "Never, Lord. These things will never happen to you." Now, I probably shouldn't have said it that way. What I meant was, "You can't leave us, Lord. Who would we be? What would all this mean without you?" But he scolded me. He reprimanded me in front of the whole group. Told me I didn't understand the things of God. And I didn't. So that night when we sat down for the Passover and he wanted to wash our feet, I said, "No, that's servant's work." But then he said, "Unless I wash you, you will never be clean." "All right, Lord, then my head and my hands, whatever you want." He just looked tired. "You are clean," he said. "But not all of you. One of you will betray me." Well, that started a whole new round of bickering. When the meal was finally done, we were all exhausted. There was nothing I wanted to see more than a bed. But then Jesus announced that he was going off to a garden to pray, a place called Gethsemane. Anybody want to join him? Well, tired as we were, we went. We were his disciples. "Stay awake with me," he said. "Watch and pray that you do not fall into temptation." "Yes, Lord, whatever you want." But within a few minutes, I was already drifting off, leaning up against a tree. And when I opened my eyes, Jesus was bending down right close to me. "Could you not stay awake 1 hour?" he said. I tried to look alert, but he got even more serious. "Simon," he said, "Satan has demanded to have you. He wants to sift you like wheat." Well, that woke me up. My blood ran cold. Surely Satan didn't know who I was. "You told him no, right?" "I have prayed for you, Simon, that your strength will not fail." "Lord," I whispered. I don't know why I was whispering, because suddenly the night felt loud. The world felt big and scary, like the sea when I was a boy. And I had that feeling again, like I was going to drown. "Lord, I would lay down my life for you." "Would you?" he said. And then he looked over my shoulder as if he saw something coming. I tell you the truth, Peter. Tonight, before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. And then the night crackled. There was a rustle in the trees and footsteps along the path. And suddenly the garden of prayer was invaded by armed soldiers. Judas was leading the way. Judas, our companion, his follower, my friend. And suddenly I realized they had come to arrest him. And he wasn't even going to put up a fight. Jesus, I wanted to say, this is not a game. Run, fight, disappear, call down fire, do something. But he didn't. He went with them. I made them look foolish, sending all these armed guards to arrest a man who didn't even resist. But it wasn't like he surrendered. It was like resolve. At that point, the 12 of us just melted into the darkness. Judas disappeared quickly before we could grab him. And the others just scattered in pairs or one by one. No one knew where to go or what to do. Jesus didn't ask us to follow him. Maybe he knew us too well. And I couldn't get those words out of my head. Satan has desired to sift you like wheat. I was afraid of what was to come. They took him to the house of the high priest. And outside in the courtyard, there was a fire. So I got close to warm my hands and try to hear what people were saying. Maybe they would just warn him and let him go. That's how it had happened before. But this time felt different. And then I noticed across the fire, 2 girls whispering, and one of them pointed at me. That man was with him. He's one of them, she said. Well, the fire popped, and I answered quickly, "You're wrong. I don't know him." The lie burned a little, but I pushed down the guilt and just slipped back into the shadows. People came and went that night, even some of the disciples. We acted like we didn't know each other. And toward dawn, I was getting tired again when another man accused me. You were with him, with the prisoner. Who, me? I said, no. My heart pounding in my chest. I didn't like the way some of the soldiers were looking at me. I don't even know the man, I said. Sure you don't, said one of the guards, picking up his spear. Listen to his accent. He's clearly one of them. I don't know what you're talking about, I said, more loudly than I meant to. And just then, the high priest's door opened. And in the light of the fire, we could see Jesus being held by 2 guards. It was clear he'd been beaten. Not like what was to come, but he had already been beaten and battered and slapped around. And he looked at me, right at me, as he had so many times. And my stomach turned. And then the rooster crowed. It's funny in life that often the one thing you know not to do is the one thing you end up doing. Before the rooster crows, he had said 3 times. I had to get out of there. I leapt up from the fire, tripping over legs and logs, and I just started to run. I didn't care where. I just ran as fast as my legs could carry me. And when they couldn't carry me anymore, I collapsed and I wept. And the next time I saw Jesus, he was dead. When someone's gone, your world is full of all the things you never said. I'm thankful for you. I love you. Can you tell me about the time? You think of a story they would have loved or a song you used to sing together. But of all the things you never said, the worst is I'm sorry. the need to apologize, to make things right. And I had lost that chance. Now, the days after Jesus' death were just a blur. We eventually found each other again, everyone except Judas, found our way back to that same room where we had had our last supper with Jesus. And I so wanted to feel his presence there, but I didn't. None of us did. And so we argued and blamed and wept. But on the third day, in the morning, the reports began coming in. First, it was the women coming back, saying the tomb was empty, that he had risen, whatever that meant. Mary said she'd actually seen him and spoken with him. And then the two from Emmaus came in. They said they'd had a meal with him. Well, John and I ran out to see for ourselves. "It's true," John said, standing outside the empty tomb. "What's true?" I said. "What in all the world can be believed, can be relied on now?" It wasn't until that night when he appeared with us in that very room, showed us his hands and his feet, spoke peace into our hearts, that I began to believe it was true. He had been dead and now was alive again. It happened again a week later, same time, same place. But both times in that room, I hung back. I felt unworthy. And ever since he had first called me that day by the sea, I so wanted to earn my way, to show him I was ready to take my place. But now I knew the truth. I could never earn my way. None of us could. He had warned us. And yet when he needed us most, where were we? Asleep, hiding, worse. He didn't need us. He had died and come back to life. What did he need us for? I believed in his resurrection. It proved he was the Son of God, that death was breakable. But the mess I'd made of things, that was just beyond repair. As the days passed, we left Jerusalem, tried to get on with our lives. Now, some of us found our way back to Galilee, to our homes by the sea. Old habits die hard, and one night, I just needed to get away. "I'm going fishing," I said, wanting to be alone. And suddenly they all stood up. "I'm going too," they said. Nathaniel, Thomas, James, John, the whole bunch of them. So instead of listening to the sound of waves lapping against the boat all night, I listened to a group of men snoring all night long. We hardly talked. We caught nothing. It really was like old times. But as dawn was breaking, the sun just coming up, we noticed a man on shore, and he called out to us. "My sons," he said, "have you any fish?" Was there no peace? "No," John shouted, "no fish." And the man answered back, "Cast your net on the other side of the boat." And the morning air stuck to my lungs. In the first rays of light, the sea seemed to sparkle. And as soon as that net hit the water, it was so full of fish, we couldn't even pull it in. "It's the Lord," John whispered. And I suddenly let out the breath I didn't even know I'd been holding. I had to talk to him. I could not let another chance pass. So I threw myself overboard, just as clumsy as when I had fallen in as a boy, but with all the resolve of that night I walked on the waves. and I splashed and thrashed my way to shore. When I got there, I found him crouching beside a fire. It looked like him, but not exactly like him. Eventually, the others caught up, and no one dared ask him, but we knew it was him. "Come," he said, "have some breakfast. Have some breakfast." I hadn't had an appetite for days, but that morning I ate. And when we were done, he motioned for me to walk with him. "Here it comes," I thought. "The reprimand. Your services are no longer needed, Simon." But I went with him anyway. No matter what he was going to say, I just needed to be with him. We had only taken a couple of steps when he said, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" And he gestured toward the village and the boats and the sea. "Yes, Lord," I said. "You know that I love you." "Feed my lambs," he said, without looking at me. And then he asked again, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" "Yes, Lord," I said again. "You know that I love you." "Tend my sheep," he said. And then he asked again, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" "Lord," I said. And it hurt that he had to ask again 3 times. "Lord, you know everything. And you know that I love you." And when I said it, it was like I was no longer sinking. It was like he had lifted me again out of the water. And I knew I was imperfect, I was foolish, I was weak, but I was forgiven. There was still a place for me. And we stood there side by side looking out on the water, the very place where my journey had begun and now was about to begin again. He looked at me as he did that very first day. And he said, "Follow me." And I thought, I can do that. I don't know where it's going to lead. But if I've learned anything from following Jesus, it's that he can be trusted. When I was a man, I nearly drowned in a sea of fear and regret and pride. But a man called Jesus, my teacher and Lord and friend, found me in the storm. He told me to come to him, and he showed me that my failures never have the final say. He is the finest man and the greatest fisherman I have ever known, and I intend to fish with him as long as I live.